So we're looking this evening just a bit more about integration and positive emotion. And obviously you've all been studying Sabuti's talks, so you know there's a lot of material in there. But I just wanted to give a bit more from my own perspective, I suppose. So the first question, in a way, we're doing all these talks about the five aspects of Sangharakshita's system of Dharma life. But why do we need another system? Why do we need another path? Why isn't it that the Eightfold Path or the Threefold Path or the Twelvefold Path aren't enough? You know, why do we have to have something else or another system to add on? Well, maybe, you know, it is enough to have those other paths. But Bhante felt that there was another way of looking at it. And he developed the five aspects and the system of the Dharma life over time, even starting from 1976. So there's a seminar that Karen D mentioned on Nagarjuna's precious garland. And one morning when they were gathered for study, Bhante quite spontaneously started talking about the five aspects. So it's not in Nagarjuna's precious garland. He just started talking about it in that seminar. And he was basing it on an old Indian tradition. And that's what he was doing. You know, he was trying to explore the Dharma in this new modern Western context. And thinking through what was necessary, what was helpful to people. And that's how this arose. And I'm sure you'll find that she is very helpful, and it does summarise something about the nature of the spiritual life. Because what the system of Dharma life is doing is it's working with, in a way, the forces of existence itself towards a vision beyond the self, towards a vision beyond even a path of individual development. It's working towards a vision of the potentiality of well, what's possible within existence for ourselves and others. So what are the forces of existence that it's working with? Well, the Dharma life is not random. It's not that by chance enlightenment suddenly comes upon you or the bodhicitta suddenly arises. That will be a nihilistic view. It will be a view that actions don't have consequences. So it's not that it's just by chance that the bodhicitta arises or one gains enlightenment. And it's not that it's governed by an external authority, for example, God. That would be an eternalist view. It's not bestowed upon you. All our lives are governed by conditions. And this is the sort of, in a way, the forces of existence that we're working with. All our lives are governed by conditions and conditioned arising. And Sangharakshita talks about that as a law whose operation is as the heartbeat of Buddhism. The law that when the conditions for a production of a phenomena, from the falling of a leaf to the birth of the Buddha, are present, or birth of a Buddha, are present, the effect will inevitably follow. So whatever happens, whatever is produced in existence, is governed by conditions. And it's only when those conditions are present that that thing will arise, whether we're talking about the falling of a leaf or the birth of a Buddha. And this is what Sangharakshita is really exploring in the Survey of Buddhism, that within conditionality, the birth of a Buddha is possible. And he calls this creative conditionality. So conditioned arising. So we're all used to looking at the wheel of life. But also there's the spiral path, which is a different, in a way, different mode of conditioned arising that positive mental states tend to augment each other. So you'll be familiar with the 12 positive nidanas that and the spiral path. And I think, in a way, what that shows is there's a possibility of moving beyond the confinement of self-clinging, moving beyond the ego project. And because there's a possibility of, in a way, moving beyond ourselves or our limited self-view, that we long for it. It's because it's there as a potential. Something in us knows that, and that's why we long for it. And that's why there's always a sense that actually there could be more. There could be more. And this is what makes Buddhism, in a way, from my opinion, a profoundly optimistic religion. Because it's saying that actually, wherever you are, whatever's going on for you, you know in your bones that it's possible to be more, and you know in your bones that it's possible to be liberated. And that, in a sense, is what I see my Dharma life about. I find the Vimalakirti Nidesha very, very important to me as a sort of manual for building the Buddha land, a very strange and esoteric manual. But one of the things that there's a story about, where Vimalakirti says to a Buddhist teacher, he says, don't put rotten food into this bowl. He says, don't just give people limited teachings. He said, these people in their previous lives have found the jewel of the Dharma. The aspiration to the bodhicitta is within them. So you need to teach them about bodhicitta and enlightenment. Don't just teach them a small version of the teachings. Actually, there's this kind of vision that all beings have, in a way, they know it. They know that the Dharma is possible, that the enlightenment is possible. They know the bodhicitta is possible. Within their lives, they've sort of seen that. And you just need to remind them of that. So in a way, teaching the Dharma is not about presenting something new, in a sense, or even a limited version of the Dharma that you think people will be more comfortable with. It's reminding them of what they already know. The Pratitya Samuppada is put within these five niyamas, or sets of regularity within conditioned arising. And I'm sure we've looked at them in our groups. So first of all, we have the Uta Niyama, physical and chemical sort of processes. The Bija Niyama, which is more biological processes. The Mano Niyama, which is instinctual consciousness. And the processes that go with instinctual consciousness. But on the basis of Mano Niyama, Karma Niyama arises. So on the basis of instinctual consciousness, Karma Niyama arises. Something special happens, and we have an ability to stand outside our interaction with our surroundings. We have an ability to stand back and sort of look at ourselves and our actions. In a way, we have an ability to sort of stand outside of time and see what's happening and see ourselves in that context. And this means that we can plan for the future and we can learn from the past. So we can condition ourselves. We can decide who we want to be, to a limited extent, but we can create our own future at that point and who we become. We start to have more choice in our actions. And that's the force of karma. It means that if we undertake certain habitual actions, our actions turn into our habits. They sort of, the more we do something, the more we sort of create a groove in our being, if you like, a sort of momentum in our being, and it's more likely we'll do that in the future. So our actions become our habits, and our habits become our personality, and then we shape the way we experience the world, and even to an extent the world that we actually live in, through our actions and through our personality. So the law of karma is saying, in a way, we're creating ourselves and we're creating our world all the time, in ever deeper ways. And we have a choice about what we create of ourselves and what we create of the world we live in. I mean, you know, to a limit, it's not total, you know, brings in the whole debate about free will, but, you know, not to a limitless way, but actually we can reshape our future. And we're all here because we've done that. You know, if you hear people's stories, you've heard what changes they've made and how we've all created something of ourselves, how we've chosen the direction that we want our lives to head in and what world we want to live in. And it's on dependence upon those kind of actions that the Dharma Niyama processes arise. So these are the processes that are beyond even self-creation, because they're beyond self-identification. And it's not that you then at that point sort of slip back into instinctual consciousness where you just don't know what you think and feel anymore. It's more like you transcend that self-clinging. You open out into something much, much broader than me and my inward-looking concerns. You're no longer attached to that sort of self-identity and self-drama. Bhante calls this stage the stage of spontaneous compassionate activity. So you're able to see yourself much broader than ego clinging. In a way, you enter into a field of consciousness that responds spontaneously to the needs of the greater whole, because you're no longer solely identified with yourself. It's not that you disappear, it's not that you then ignore your own needs, but it's more like you're seeing your needs in a vaster context than just yourself. And, you know, when I was reading about Tsongkhapa's enlightenment experience, and he said that what he really realised was just how profound, in his enlightenment, he realised just how profound our actions can be. That's what he realised. He realised what a tremendous effect he could have on others, because he was interrelated to the whole, which I thought was quite an interesting way to look at enlightenment, to realise actually the profound effect one can have on others for the good. So the Dharma Niyama processes may not have fully arisen in us, but we feel them. I think we know them. We know that they're there. Maybe we feel them as a longing. Maybe we feel them as a pull, a nameless pull, you know. It doesn't have to be that you've worked it out. It's more like a sort of soft whisper in the back of your ear, or a call, or a song that, you know, when you still your mind down, you can hear this song leading you into the forest. That's how I think of it. And that's the vision. That's the vision of what is possible, not just for us, but for all beings, which is why I really like this vision that we've been talking about of the Sanghakaya, the body of the Sangha, that we can create something together that's more than the sum of its parts. We can create something together that transcends each individual but doesn't exclude the individual. And that's the Sanghakaya, and we can participate in that. And sometimes you get that feeling. I think if I get that feeling of Dharma Niyama processes emerging, I definitely get that in the context of a strong Sangha context, maybe on retreat here, or maybe in an order context. Yeah. So yes, we use this. The I'm having to look at this because I can't remember what it's called. The five aspects of Sangha's system of Dharma life. We use them, the system of Dharma life, as a way to use Karma Niyama processes to go beyond Karma Niyama processes. In a sense, what we're doing with Karma Niyama processes is we're becoming less selfish, less inward looking. And by doing that, in the words of the Ratnaguna Sanchayagata, we remove the obstructing defilements and clear away the taints. And when we remove the obstructing defilements and clear away the taints, we're able to hear the wisdom of the Buddhas. We're able to give ourselves truly and totally to the Dharma, to the truth, to the way things are at that point. We're able to fully surrender to Dharma Niyama processes. The way the Buddha put it, which is characteristically practical and to the point, he said it's the clean cloth that takes the dye. So that's what we're doing with the Karma Niyama processes. We're cleaning the cloth and taking the dye. So it's a system of growth, and it takes into account our whole life, both on and off the cushion. And we can see it as a sequential path, a vertical path, And there's a mandala of elements that have to be present in all stages. So we can see it also as a horizontal system. It happens at all levels of going for refuge. And then that's what Subhuti goes into in much more depth in initiation into a new life. So just look a little bit about the path and the mandala. So in the path model of the system of Dharma life, what this means is that we look at how to work with the karma niyama processes in developing integration and positive emotion. And at that point, you know, we've cleaned the cloth to take the dye, and at that point we're sort of entering into spiritual death and spiritual rebirth, and that's the point of ordination. So ordination is sort of traditionally, if we can call it a tradition, but that's where we where Sangharakshita at least talks about ordination. In a way, what we've done is we've made ourselves a happy, healthy human being, to a certain extent. One isn't necessarily happy all the time, but you make yourself into a sort of substantial human being that's robust enough to let go into spiritual receptivity and then let the Dharma Niyama process emerge, processes emerge in spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. So yes, I think the spiritual receptivity in the path model is more like that space in which spiritual death and spiritual rebirth can emerge. And that's the point at ordination. We're looking for those two elements. Firstly, the element of being a substantial, responsible, aware individual who also has a taste of the mystery. We always used to call it the touch of the transcendental. It's very difficult to work out whether someone has the touch of the transcendental. I'm sure I have the touch of the transcendental most of the time, but there's something a little bit other. There's something where this self-clinging, whatever it is, has not quite got a full hold on someone. There's the gravitational pull. That's the other thing Sangharakshita talks about. The gravitational pull of nirvana is calling them on, and they know it. So yeah, so that's the symbolism of the path. And I think the symbolism of the path can be underrated. But actually, if you look at it, if you look at mythology, the journey, it's the myth of the journey. And that's such a strong myth for people. In a way, all stories are journeys. A journey of transformation. And sometimes I think in a way it's important with all journeys not to just see it as totally focused on what's going to happen at the end, but also in and of itself. You know, there's something about, you know, even going for a walk around here, and obviously we're going on looped walks, we're not trying to get anywhere, we're just trying to come back here, hopefully. So it's not just about the end, but it's also about that sort of journey of discovery of walking through overgrown paths and hearing the soft footsteps as you walk along the path, and taking notes of the secret places, and even getting lost sometime and realizing that you're lost, and knowing the resources that you bring to mind when you are lost. That's the beautiful thing about being lost, is you know what you're really made of. It's a brilliant thing getting lost on solitary. You have to go through real fear, you know. Mm-hmm. And then you call on some resources you didn't know you had. And you do that because it's beautiful. It's beautiful to be a wanderer through the paths of existence, like Milarepa or the Buddha, who just, you know, he wandered all around North India just waiting for people to teach. And there's that beautiful symbolism of the ox herding pictures where the last stage is walking through the market with bliss bestowing hands. You know, you don't stop at the end of the journey, you just keep walking. But you walk through into the marketplace with bliss bestowing hands. Yeah. And the thing about path journeys as well is we don't really always know where we're going or how we'll particularly get there. And you have an idea about where you're going, but your idea never matches up to reality. The reality turns out to be very, very different from this idea that we've got of the path of the spiritual life. And I think that's a cause for rejoice, because really our view is pretty limited, actually. if I think about what I thought about the journey of ordination and spiritual life when I was 20, when I asked for ordination, my goodness, thank goodness it didn't turn out like that. So I've got a quote from Arloco, which is, I do like this quote. He said, "In 1976, I formally committed myself to a course of action about which I had a whole jumble of ideas. None of these have really turned out to be of much use, except their gradual abandonment has provided a path of debris, offering the consolation that I have actually moved from where I started. In short, the practice of the Dharma, or my attempted practice at least, has not turned out to be remotely what I thought it might be like, I'm pleased to say." So sometimes, you know we've moved because we can see all the things we've shed behind us, all the old ideas and old views of ourselves and crackpot theories. I'm full of crackpot theories, you know, and you just end up just dropping them on the ground behind you.
Sorry, I just thought
of this book. Yeah, I know. It's terrible, isn't it? As long as no one else picks them up. Anyway, so the problem is that with the path is that you can think you've done a stage, you know, you can think you've done integration now, or you've done positive emotion, and it's time to move on. But actually, each stage is profound and limitless. You have to do them again and again and again at ever deeper levels. And also, if we look at too much at things as a path, we can sort of think about ordination as a stage on the path, which in one sense it is, but then we can always see it as a bit far away, like I'm never going to quite reach there, or I'm not totally skillful all the time, so I'll never get ordained, that kind of thing. It's always a bit further on. So it's very important to also see the system of Dharma life as always unfolding within our spiritual life, and every stage is being developed in every moment. And this is a kind of mandala image. And, you know, good to acknowledge that we have some feeling for all the stages now. And it's important to keep that sense of all the stages in our life now, because then the Dharma life becomes a living presence in our life in all its aspects. So I wanted to just say a few things about integration and positive emotion as a path from the mandala. So actually the mandala image is an image of integration, because as we heard in the puja the other night, we take an aspect of reality and we surround it with beauty. It's sort of, we arrange our lives to be sort of radiating from around a central point. In the early Buddhist tradition, I always love this, I've got a real thing about the Gandakuti. You know, the Buddha lived when he had the rainy season retreat in Shravasti, he stayed in what was known as the Gandakuti, which is the hut, the perfumed hut. And if you go there now, it still exists. I think it does. Anyway, you can go what they say is the Gandakuti. And it's always absolutely filled with fragrant roses. It's still a Gandakuti because there were so many offerings to the Buddha, they said, that his whole hut smelt perfumed of these roses. And it said of the area around his Gandakuti was the jewel slab. And this is the early understanding of the mandala, what became very brought out in the tantric tradition. And you can still see those in Sri Lanka, in India, you can see these kind of semicircles around any doorway in Buddhist temples, the old Buddhist temples, not the new ones, but in the old ruins. Very, very highly decorated slabs. Anyway, that's a bit of an aside. But I really love that image of there's the Buddha sitting in the Gandakuti, this fragrant chamber, and all around it is the jewel slab. Well, that's your life, in a sense, if the Buddha is at the centre of your life. He perfumes your life. Whatever your life is, you know, whether it's your career or your children or your partner or your Sangha friends or your work, whatever it is, whatever's going on there, it perfumes it. And we will have all had that experience. But we can only become integrated when there's a strong ideal at the centre of the mandala. In a way, the strong ideal at the centre of the mandala organises the rest of our lives around that ideal. And I think that's what happens in the prostration practice. Well, for me anyway, everything makes sense in the prostration practice. Because there you are with a very strong central ideal. Whatever part of that you're paying attention to at the moment, in that moment, because you know the refuge tree is quite big and complex, and one tends to sort of zoom in on certain aspects at different times. So you've got this sort of strong ideal at the centre. There is the Buddha and Buddhahood throughout time, and there are the manifestations of the Dharma itself manifesting throughout centuries and through time and space, different countries. So you have that kind of strong central ideal, and then here's you with the rest of your life. You know, your mum and dad, whatever's going on for you about your mum and dad. Actually, my mum and dad know that I do the prostration practice, even though they're both Christian. Sometimes I say, oh, I've been doing the prostration practice, you've been next to me. Thank you very much, dear. I was feeling a lot of love for you both, which I do. But yeah, I mean, normally we don't necessarily tell our parents, but or anyone else who's in there. But that is the image. You've got something strong and sense, and suddenly everything makes sense of your life. You know, it's a very integrating force. And sometimes even if you feel like, you know, there's different parts of yourself that are quarrelling a bit, you can imagine them there, all doing the prostration practice. So there's, you know, the stroppy teenager. And whoever else is in your, I don't know, your sub-personalities rocking around your brain. But, you know, they're there in the practice. You can even sometimes imagine them quite wholeheartedly. The little girl, for example. And there you are with your life, and you're in relationship to what's highest for you and for others. And everything seems to sort of fall into place. So yes, so that's what we're looking for in integration, is what's really at the centre of your mandala, what's your organising principle. And the rest doesn't have to be totally smooth. It's almost like you've got a king or a queen, in our case, you've got a queen at the centre of your mandala. Well, you know, there might be a few quarrelling border regions, and but you know what's going on, and you're still sort of in control. And this is important for ordination as well, because one of the things that Sandra actually says is, he says you can only make a commitment when you're integrated. Only the integrated can commit. Because only the if you can only sort of decide what to do and then do it if you are responsible for all those different parts of yourself, if you know where you're moving and how to move there. So integration is the sort of essential ingredient for commitment. And we all know this because sometimes we make a promise, for example, when we're not fully behind that promise. And then another part of ourselves comes in at a different stage. And then we can't follow through on our promise. So yes, and part of it is knowing the conditions that you need as well. Knowing who you are and what conditions you need to flourish, to live out that ideal, with the ideal in the centre of your mandala. But I'd like to also add a suggestion, which is the mandala is 3D. Because Sangharakshita also talks about horizontal and vertical integration. So in horizontal integration, he talks about overcoming conflict and disharmony within ourselves. He says we need to get ourselves functioning as a smoothly working whole, not a jumble of bits and pieces and fragments of cells, all struggling and jostling for supremacy. And it's interesting to ask oneself, well, is that how I feel? Do I feel that there's lots of bits, lots of fragments and bits and pieces of cells, all struggling for supremacy? And do I feel like all those bits of myself are in harmony with each other? Or at least a working relationship? Yeah. And of course that's what happened when Sangharakshita talks about Sangharakshita 1 and 2. You know, Sangharakshita 1, I think it's this way around anyway, he's the philosopher monk. and Sangharakshita too, who's a kind of poet and mystic. And he said it was only the Dharma that really pulled those pieces of himself together. Otherwise he might have broken apart. So there's something where we feel like we've got to have whatever's in the centre of our mandala, all those bits and pieces have to be in relationship to that. And that's what the beauty of the Dharma, from my point of view, is that in a way it can take the whole of me. And it's limitless. It can take the whole of me as I am, and even further. I think that's also the symbolism of the Vishvavadra, which is in a way another sort of came out. The Buddha stands on the perfume, on the jeweled slab, which is a mandala, but he also stands on the diamond throne. The Vishvavadra is the symbol of integration. Because it's two vajras crossed. And what that means to me, when I think about that symbolism, is also about being able to be with contradictions. Because I think, you know, we are contradictory in ourselves. There are different pools, and we can't expect to sort of be just one complete person. We have to know all those different pools. We have to be in relation to our contradictory bits of our character. I think I was talking about it this morning in my group about my own sort of personal journey of there's a very sort of strong, reflective and almost mystical side, and yet a side that really wants to go out in the world and help people. And I need something that can bring those two things together. And that for me is the Dharma. So integration is really about being congruency. Means being congruent with your thoughts, speech and action all moving together in the same direction and in relationship to each other. It's very painful if we feel like our thoughts, speech and action are moving in different directions. I think that's a very painful experience. It's a bit like when we're doing something but we know our mind is somewhere else. I find that sometimes in pujas. You know, I just think, my God, I've just lost my attention. You know, suddenly we're on rejoicing in merit and I'm still on salutation because I was thinking about something completely different. So, and I find that quite painful. I find it quite painful in meditation actually, just to realise that, you know, I'm sitting there's my actions, but my thoughts are somewhere else. Or I'm talking to someone, but actually my thoughts are somewhere else. So integration is about taking responsibility for our thoughts and speech and action. And taking responsibility, particularly it's interesting to reflect on taking responsibility with our thoughts. Because I think that's where the area where we think we can get away with things. You know, because no one's going to see inside your brain. But the thing about thoughts is that thoughts have a tendency to manifest themselves, particularly ones we put a lot of energy behind. So we have to take responsibility for the thoughts that we choose to dwell on. The thoughts that we really, really entertain, as it says in the Dhammapada. And the things that we say and the things that we do. So when Sangharakshita talks about this, he says, when he's talking about awareness of the self, it's interesting that he says, you are aware of your physical body, its positions, its movements. You are also aware of your emotions, whether positive or negative, and of your thoughts, of ideas, concepts, reflections, reasoning. So that's interesting. So you're aware of your ideas, you're aware of your views and your own reasoning behind something. You know what you're thinking and the line your thinking tends to take, and your reflections. And he says, you're aware of your conditioning too, the extent to which you have been conditioned by your upbringing, your environment, your early experiences, your associations, your particular skills and tendencies, your likes and dislikes. You are aware of your own basic motivations. So you know, Subhuti talks about knowing your own character. You know what's conditioned you. And you know your own basic motivations. You know what you like and you don't like. And I suppose when we know ourselves well, we're also, and take responsibility for ourselves, We also have to take responsibility for our effect on others, the effect of our thoughts and our speech and our actions on others and how we create our world. And I think this is particularly true at ordination because when you're ordained, what you say and do, the effect of that is magnified. So like it or not, that's what happens. You know, if it's just the way things, if I walk into the kitchen and shout at someone, you're going to feel that because it's not just a human being who's just done that to you. It's also a member of the order, which you've just asked to talk in. You know, so, and I think actually it's quite good to realise that. I think that's been quite a practice on myself. I found it particularly in relation to me swearing, actually, because I do have a bit of a habit of swearing. And actually, there's something about being in the order which actually makes me think, well, you know, if you swear, it's going to have an effect on other people. And it's not just you swearing, it's like an order member swearing. And what does that say? You know, and I find that a really valuable opportunity to actually reflect on my own actions of speech and body. I think it's an opportunity if you can step up to it. And, you know, becoming a private preceptor is also the same thing. I remember having this, I had a bit of a ding-dong, a bit of an argument with someone on an order weekend. And my friend took me aside and she said, Vajitara, you reacted. I don't know, but I mean, did you hear what she just said? And I was in the consultation process of being a private preceptor and my friend just said to me, doesn't matter what she said, you're the one who's about to be a private preceptor and you just have to not react. I was like, oh wow, you know, God, I can't even react on an order weekend. Anyway. So yeah, it does, that is part of the responsibility of being an order member. But it's not just, yeah, as I said, it's not just speech and actions, it's also thoughts. Thoughts have power, what you entertain. So it's also very important from this regard, if we're really taking responsibility of our thoughts, to distinguish between thoughts as karma and thoughts as vipaka. Because otherwise you're going to feel guilty for every little thought that comes into your head. But from a Buddhist point of view, thinking is one of the sense bases, it's one of sense experiences. It's what you think immediately is a result of former actions. What you put your energy behind in those thoughts is your karma. So it's a very interesting exercise. You can save yourself a lot of irrational guilt by reflecting on your thoughts and whether your thought just pops up. It's a habitual conditioned thought in a particular circumstances, whether it pops up or whether you really are giving it energy. You know, because if someone has wronged us, we will feel, you know, there will be a thought that's based on irritation and ill will that pops up into your head. You might, for example, think, I just hate you. I hate you and I don't want to be in this room with you. That's probably, most of that is for Parker. It's, you know, it's you're annoyed by certain things because of a result of your previous experiences. So it just pops up into your head. What we've got to do is see that the thought arises in our head, but we don't have to act on it. You know, we can actually do something different. We don't have to entertain those thoughts. So that's what the Dhammapada is talking about, is saying what thoughts you actually entertain, you know, where you really, really put your energy behind some thoughts that arise in the mind. It's very, very important to be aware of the difference, because all sorts of thoughts will pop up into your head. But what you choose to dwell on, that's the karma. So that's kind of horizontal integration. You know what's going on in your head and in your actions, and you take responsibility for that, and you bring all those into relationship with this strong central ideal. But there's also integrating the depths and the heights, vertical integration. So Bhante talks about the unconscious mind becomes integrated by the conscious mind, and your conscious mind becomes aware of your unconscious mind. So it means basically the whole lot becomes visible. You thought you were so nice until you started practicing the Dharma. It's interesting. interesting, actually. I was watching an old video of a 1970s retreat that Hunty led in Keffels. And there was on that retreat, there was a Japanese teacher who later saw himself as Maitreya. Anyway, he was talking about meditation, and he was talking about meditation, said, well, when you meditate, you have this experience of all things being one, and you realise the sort of oneness of all existence. And you can really feel it when he's talking, and you feel like this guy really is in something, you know. And then when it cuts to Bhante, and Bhante said, yes, well, when you meditate, what you discover is all sorts of things about yourself you didn't know, like you're really angry. And I thought, in a way, both are true. You do uncover this sort of, I don't know, sense of mystical oneness. But you also discover the fact that you're really angry. And you've got negative emotions. And sometimes it can feel like in Dharma practice we're getting worse. But actually what we're doing is we're integrating ourselves. And I've got a lot of confidence in people's psyches. I think that people's psyches only let things up when they're ready to receive them. So, you know, stuff bubbles up from the depths. Some stuff that you thought you'd buried long ago and wasn't even an issue. And it's embarrassing, you know, stuff from childhood and things that, you know, you just wish you weren't there. And terrible. Anyway, more is revealed and it carries on. Unintegrated part carries on. And you can take it. You know, the trick is not to see that as your fixed identity, I think. And I've definitely had the experience myself of feeling like I've been followed by something, something unpleasant. And if people know the real me, then they'll see this unpleasant thing, whatever it is. So I've got to keep this unpleasant thing at bay. But actually, when I've come into relationship with that unpleasant thing, whatever it is, what I've realised is it's a ghost. It's a shadow. It doesn't have any real substance. And I think that's a process of integration, is also turning to face that shadow and seeing, actually, it's just a shadow. It's not substantial. It's not me. It's not mine. And what helped me to reflect on that is I think it doesn't really matter what anyone has ever done. It's not the Dharma to say that the real you is this unpleasant thing. If you start thinking there's an unpleasant thing that's the real you, that's not a dharmic view. Because from a dharmic point of view, everyone's conditioned. There is no real you lurking in the shadows to jump out. So there you go. It's not true for anyone. Hooray. So yes, we uncover the unconscious depth. It's not always negative, actually. Sometimes it's also very, very positive. You know, there's something wonderful within you that's waking up and getting involved. Sandra talks about all these archetypes living in the cellar. Most of the time they're just truly bored. The kings and the queens and the warrior princess and the, I don't know, the magician. And they're all in your psyche in this cellar. And every so often one of them looks up and says, what's she doing? And they go back to sleep. And then when you start to practice the Dharma, it's like, they look up, what's she doing? Ah, interesting. They all start waking up, you know, putting on their armour, their fairy wings, their crowns, whatever. I think I've probably got a bit of a diva in me. Feather boa. We're on. So, you know. But there's also, yes, the unconscious mind, he says, becomes integrated with the superconscious mind, whatever that is, the superconscious mind. Actually, he's relating that more to the higher dhyanas. But I think what he also means is that we're aware of our potential. It is that thing that we suddenly become aware of our capacity, our heights, not just our depths, but our heights and what's possible for us. There's a certain sutra where he talks about that all beings have the cry of shunyata, unconditioned and unconfined. And that cry is there before you've stepped out of ignorance. So I think part of integration is realising there's a potential in you for enlightenment, a potential for you to be part of the bodhicitta arising, or there's the cry of shunyata, unconditioned and unconfined, and you start to hear that, and it starts to dictate what you need to do in your life. And sometimes we can get this sense, I think, in the midst of dukkha, we can be aware of something unaffected by dukkha. I don't know if anyone has had this experience, like you can be in the real, well, the pants of existence, you know, crying or in utter abject misery of whatever form. And yet at the same time, there's this unexplained bliss. I feel that, I'm increasingly feeling that actually, that I can be really, really struggling in some way, and yet there's something that's not defined by that struggle. There's something in me that won't be defined by that, or by past habits, or by, you know, this sort of centering around myself, or that sort of innate selfishness that we all hold. There's something in me that's not defined by that. Yeah. So Bhante also says, when he says awareness, he talks about awareness of the self, he says, essentially you are aware of your own irreplaceable uniqueness. You are intensely, luminously aware. You feel the very vibration of your own individual existence. You are aware of yourself as sharply distinguished, differentiated from the whole of the rest of nature. That's a bit shocking, because we like to think of ourselves as part of nature. Anyway, I just kept that in because I've been pondering that. But I think in a way there is something to it, that nature has created something that's beyond nature in the sense that it can stand back and look at itself, which is human beings and self-reflexive consciousness. And we're aware of ourselves, and because we're aware of ourselves, because we can stand back and look at ourselves, we're aware of what we could be, not just what we are. We feel the very vibration of our own individual existence, intensely, luminously aware, aware of our own irreplaceable uniqueness. But you know, integration can't end there. It can't be enough to be congruent or even to be moving in the same direction. It's not even enough just to be responsible. It's not even enough just to be aware of our own irreplaceable uniqueness. Because we've got to also be aware of what we're creating and decide what we're creating. You know, we've got to make a decision what we're going to shape out of this existence that we're aware of, and that we can make choices within. So really, integration is about the capacity to make choices, but positive emotion is about being aware of what choice, sort of determining what choices we make. And, you know, Subhuti talks very much about distinguishing karma from vipaka, so the fruits of action from action. Because we all have a propensity to certain sanskaras. We all have a propensity to certain actions. Part of our sanskaras are just karma vipaka. They're conditioned by previous experiences. But we can also choose what to do with that. So all sorts of thoughts and feelings arise, but we have a choice about what we put our energy behind. We have a choice, ultimately, about what we're creating. So what do we put our energy behind? We put our energy behind what's skillful and beautiful and good. What's in Buddhism known as kalyana, the spiritual. Kalyana is a very, very rich word because it has those three sort of meanings, skillful, beautiful and good. And we respond to that. And it's very interesting, actually. I was looking, because I haven't had the easiest time recently, and I always find that when I'm struggling a bit, the best thing to do is go back to the basic Buddhist teachings. You know, not worrying about anything too highfalutin, but actually come back to the basic Buddhist teachings. So I thought, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to focus on the four right efforts, one of the least popular lists in Buddhism. But part of the Noble Eightfold Path. I'm going to go back to them, and I re-read Bhante's lecture, Transforming Self and World, and there was a sentence in there. I thought, yes, that's it. And he said, the four right efforts are becoming aesthetically active, with no explanation of that at all. But I think that's what it's about. I think the four right efforts, you know, so just reminding you, they're about eradicating negative states of mind that have arisen, preventing negative states of mind from arising, maintaining positive mental states, and cultivating positive mental states. So basically what you're doing is an exercise always of subtly moving towards the beautiful. Ah, this state has arisen in me, and it's painful. And it's not going to lead to my own welfare or the welfare of others. It's, in a way, it's sort of ugly. And I'm going to move away from that. But this state of mind is beautiful. And I'm going to cultivate beauty in my own mind, in my own being. And I'm going to cultivate, I'm going to cultivate the beautiful, I'm going to cultivate the positive. Yes, so it's being aesthetically active, it's moving towards the beautiful, moving towards what's skillful and beautiful and good, what makes our heart delight, in a sense, in terms of our own mental states, you know. So how do we know what's skillful or kusala or kalyana in our experience? Actually, it's interesting because Panti does distinguish between positive skillful emotions and spiritual emotions. And he says that spiritual emotions as opposed to skillful emotions, interesting, I didn't realise he made such a distinction, but anyway, spiritual emotions are more refined, beautiful, and related to the dhyanas. But he says not just in sitting meditation. So again, you know, Panti's really great about throwing these things out, and then you have to think about what you actually need. And he says that you have to, he says, feeling emotionally positive, whatever you are doing, even when you're just sitting quietly by yourself. So yes, I think this needs a bit of unpacking. What's the difference between positive, skillful emotions and spiritual emotions? And usually when Bhante's very specific in his use of language, spiritual usually means pertaining to the spiral path. Transcendental means pertaining to stream entry and above. But yeah, so spiritual is pertaining to at least the lower sections of the spiritual spiral path. And as we heard last night in the puja, I think what this means is really that it contains an element of shraddha. It's a positive, it's a spiritual emotion because it contains an element of shraddha. And as we heard last night, shraddha is inherent in all positive states of mind. And what that, it's good to really reflect on what does that mean in my experience? How does shraddha show itself in my experience of positive states of mind? I think for me it means that there, I can see things from a slightly bigger perspective. The etymology of kalyana, or spiritual, is to impel, or incite, or urge upwards. So there's also this state of moving up, and these spiritual emotions have a quality of moving us up, seeing from a bigger perspective, seeing from a more refined perspective. So, for example, in the Brahma Viharas, I think the Brahma Viharas are more than just a feeling. There's a song now, that's in my head. Sorry. They're more than a kind of positive feeling towards other people. That's part of it. You know, it's very important. It's a very delightful part of it. But that is essentially vipaka. It's the fruit of actions. It's not karma itself. It's not really what you're trying to develop, a positive sort of vedana or just a sort of slightly fuzzy sense of people, or happy sense. It's more, actually the Brahma Viharas are a vision of humanity. Something along the lines of the vision of humanity that the Buddha had when he saw all beings like lotuses emerging from the mud of existence. You can see all people with their struggles and their joys. You can see that they delight in happiness and they want to be happy. And you can see how that, you know, often longing to escape suffering, it is to suffering they run. You know, and it's a vision of beings wanting to grow, having that cry of shunyata, unconditioned and unconfined, moving towards the light, and really feeling that with them. So when the Buddha had that vision of lotuses, it said that he shook with beings. He had the Anukampa. He shook with those beings. And that's the Brahma Viharas. It's a vision of existence. And shaking with those beings. And that's the Shraddha. It's the knowledge that it is possible to develop more spiritual states of mind. It's possible to develop into the transcendental. Sangharakshita talks about this as cosmic going for refuge. It's a vision of existence of all beings in some way going for refuge. They're not necessarily going for refuge to the three jewels in the way that we are, but all beings have a desire to transcend themselves and to move towards that light, even if they go about it in slightly crazy ways. And that, of course, is why we're surrounded by all beings in the prostration practice. It's a vision of existence. And when you see that about beings, you can't help but to love them. Sometimes you're actually in communication with someone and you can feel you're shaking with that desire to grow that's within all beings. Sometimes you can actually feel yourself resonating. Sometimes it happens even when someone's not being particularly nice to you. It's independent of Vedana. So I've had that experience where someone's really struggling and actually they're really cross with me. And then suddenly it's like something switches in my awareness and I'm aware of this incredible desire they have to grow and the beauty of that. Yes. So skillful and spiritual emotions are developed in relation. They're social emotions. And I think this is very important in ordination because one of the things that we're looking at is our practice in relation to others. And this can be quite confusing for people because people say, well, look at my practice. You know, I meditate, I'm doing all this meditation and Dharma study, you know, at home. And you can't see that. Well, it's true. And it's good that you're doing that. But also we're trying to look at each other in relation to others. Because you only really know your positive emotion when it's tested. And it's tested by other human beings. Even the Buddha said this. He's got a whole story, which I was going to relate, but I've just noticed it's 9 o'clock, so I'm not going to. But he talks about basically you only know your metta when it's tested. And I think if we're really going to grow beyond self-clinging, we can't do that alone. This is what I've really realised. It's taken me a while, but I'm really, really sinking in. We can't really develop beyond ego clinging alone. We can't really develop positive emotion on our own. It's got to be in relation to others. And I think it's in, you know, the Vajrayana talks about the Brahma Viharas going through the fire of Shunyata. And I think that's partly about spiritual death. I think there's also, it's about partly the fire of Shunyata as other human beings. And this is Sangharakshita's genius. He's really understood why friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. Because there's something inherent about the nature of transforming ego clinging, which means that if you just do it on your own, you're not really transforming ego clinging because you're only with yourself. So there's something about being with other people that breaks open that self-clinging that you cannot do in only relation to yourself. And that's what I experience in living here in the community. It's not always that you know you're discovering your positive emotion by rubbing up against each other's reactions, but it's also about being witnessed positively. And I find that quite difficult, actually. You know, to really have yourself reflected back by your friends positively and to know that they care. It really, really undoes a whole self-view. You know, and that self-view being, I'm a lonely heroine, and I'm going to do this all myself. And I think that's so endemic in our culture, that, you know, that actually I'm an isolated human being and no one really understands me. Well, what if they do? You know, what are you going to do with that? How, are you going to be able to face that? I'm talking to myself here, but, you know, are we going to be able to face that love of another human being and being witnessed? you know, and to witness other human beings, and going into that ordination duty and have someone relate to you purely on the basis of you're going for refuge, and how people care, you know, because that's much more exposing than anything else, actually. It just takes off all your defences. So, you know, the positive emotions really are developed in relation to other human beings, and in relation to friendship, and that is quite a challenge. So, yes, yeah, so we're practicing integration and positive emotion again and again at ever more profound levels. And this means taking responsibility for our thoughts and speech and actions. It means creating something out of your life. You know, so Bhante talks about the individual being their own work of art. Well, you're your own work of art. You're creating something out of your life. And it's not forced or willful in the sort of pushy sense. It's actually also aesthetically active. It's about opening oneself to what's beautiful in oneself and allowing that to take over, and what's beautiful in others. And always having a sense of what we can become, what we are in our deepest nature. So I'm just going to finish by the quote actually that Karen Adi read out from Bhante's seminar. Because it's so simple. He says, all the time one has got five things to practice as best we can. One has to keep up the effort to be mindful and aware, and to be as together and integrated as possible. One remains in as positive mental state as one possibly can. You know, so that really means knowing ourselves, you know, knowing when it's time to just go for a walk, knowing when it's time to have a rest, knowing when it's time to speak to a friend or read a Dharma book or meditate. So one keeps in a positive mental state, as positive a mental state as one possibly can. One does not lose sight of one's ultimate goal at any time, and one tries to apply at every level whatever we've realised or discovered on the highest level of our being. Tries to apply every level whatever we've realised or discovered on the highest level of being, your being. Which means we have discovered something, you know, so it's really living from that. And doing our best for people, doing what we can to help people. This is our spiritual life, and this is our spiritual practice. These are the things with which we are basically concerned. On the practical side, this is all that we really need, all that we really need to think in terms of. Whatsoever has been said by all the different Buddhist teachers in the course of several hundred years of development is all really contained in this principle. Whatever they've said about the different stages of the paths, you can get, as I mentioned at the beginning, some very elaborate descriptions indeed, which will quite confuse you, even mislead you. This is basically what it is all about. One just intensifies one's effort in those five directions all the time, then one simply can't go wrong.